You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm right.
I'm sorry, but I cannot believe the call. You've got Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. I can't believe the call.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
Hello, and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's weekly sports podcast about the narratives in sports news and perhaps the numbers behind them. I'm Chad McMatlin, an editor at 538.com. Across from me is Neil Payne, one of our sports writers. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
And all the way, 2,000 miles south, Kate Fagan from Tampa and the Women's Final Four. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
How is the Final Four? What's the feel in Tampa, aside from warm and sunny?
It's very hot. People do believe that UConn's going to win all the way down here in Tampa. That's still the narrative.
That's really shocking.
Right. At least Florida is up on our model. You know, I'm sure they consulted 538's model and said, you know, when I get down to Florida, I know who's going to win already. And so I have also just come back from a Final Four. I was in Indianapolis, and so as you can tell by how long it took me to remember where I was as of this morning, I'm on a very little sleep because I was seeing the Final Four as well. And just to get it out there, I two-timed you guys a little bit this weekend. I recorded sort of a Hot Takedown podcast without you guys, and I'm sorry about that.
How dare you, Chad?
I know. You know, Nate Silver was there.
Yeah, that's not cool.
I know. Nate was there. Our producer, Jody Avergan, was there, and Kentucky lost, and we just couldn't keep it in. We had to record an emergency pod.
Anytime an undefeated team loses, that's an excuse. It's right, valid.
Well, I missed your guys' dulcet tones. It wasn't quite the same. So on today's show, yes, exactly. So on today's show, we are going to talk about the men's tournament and Duke's victory, and as well in our quest to make Kate a baseball fan by this summer. It's going to happen. We're going to talk opening day, the Padres, some other stuff about baseball, and then we're also going to do a new thing for Hot Takedown. We're gonna call somebody, bring an outside voice in, and talk to them about some research that they're doing. In this case, it's going to be about hockey and a statistician named Mike Lopez and some research he's done about why hockey teams stop trying to win as the season goes on. And then, of course, Allison McCann will come in also from Florida and deliver our significant digit of the week. But first, to college basketball. And we're going to talk about the men's college basketball tournament today. We are also going to talk about the women's tournament, but not today, because the final is Tuesday night. We're recording this Tuesday afternoon. And so check your Hot Takedown feeds for another emergency pod, in which we break down presumably UConn's excellence, and if not, then we break down one of the more shocking upsets to come in a long time. And so let's get to the men's tournament. On Monday night, Duke beat Wisconsin to win the NCAA championship, going an entire half with only freshmen scoring and coming from 9 points down. It was a thrilling game in the stadium, incredibly loud, like waves of noise washing over you. Pretty much a Wisconsin crowd, 70-30, I would say, Wisconsin over Duke. Duke had started the tournament with a 6% chance of winning, and then, as of last night's game, had a 47% chance, but overcame Wisconsin. And our producer, Jody Avergan, was at the stadium along with me and recorded some hot takes from disappointed Wisconsin fans leaving the stadium.
Shot of stretching missed shots for a while there. I don't know what else to say.
It was a lot of hesitation. I think it kind of got to the players going through the hard region they went through, kind of finally took its toll.
Tytus Jones, just dribble drives, was just outstanding tonight. And it was really quality program. So
Frank didn't seem to be going at him very hard in the second half. It looked like in the first half, he got those two quick fouls, but then they kind of let off after that, and we're going for the three, it looked like.
It seemed like they didn't go down low as much as they could have when they had the lead, 6-8 points, when both Justice and Okafor were out.
Well, it's very unusual for us to have that many fouls. Very unusual. And there were some tough calls that kind of turned things around, and they were making shots and we weren't.
They would always just go around us and go to the basket and make a layup, so.
Oh, sad Badgers fans.
Yet astute.
Yeah, I think so. So one of the questions I want to ask is whether that last fan was right, whether the defense was what let Wisconsin down.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I did some research for this morning on a post on our site where I looked at expected points scored and allowed for each team. And, of course, Wisconsin had the record-breaking offense during the season. And their output in the game against Duke last night, whether it's probably a combination of Wisconsin's offense just sputtering, Duke's defense and their length, that they undershot their projected offensive rating or points scored per 100 possessions by about 10 points per 100 possessions. So that was in the 22nd percentile.
And how many possessions are in a game?
In the game last night, there were exactly 60. So that ended up costing them about 6 points, and the margin of the game was 5 points. So you could say, because they undershot their expectations by that much on offense, that that was the reason that they lost. But, of course, they also undershot their projections a bit on defense as well.
Kate, what did you notice while you were watching the game?
Well, I noticed in those hot takes that you guys are awesome for always getting, like, a female voice in the hot takes.
The crowd was pretty balanced, I would say.
There was. There were so many good points that those fans made. And to me, when I was watching the game, this was all about Duke's defense, which, if you followed them all year, seemed to be their Achilles heel. I mean, sometimes they were just so shaky during the year. Coming into the tournament, you would say, all right, like, if I could see them exiting in the first round because of how poor they were playing defense. Now, as they went through this tournament, they were so, so good. They even ended, I was doing a little research because now I'm into that, now that I'm doing this hot takedown. And Duke ended the year in KenPom, everybody's ratings, as the 12th best defense, which if you saw them during the year, you would not believe that. So, for me, that's what this win was about. Certainly, Wisconsin's offensive efficiency was slowed, and Sam Decker, I think we saw a little bit of, like, regression to the mean there, airballing his first shot, shooting poorly. He had been on fire, and you see him sort of go back to an outside shooter that mirrored the one that we've seen throughout his Wisconsin career. And Wisconsin's defense just is not good enough to win an NCAA title. There was a piece up on Grantland today talking about how since 2004, every single champion has finished in the top 20 of KenPom's defensive ratings, and they've had a guard who played in the NBA. And I think you see Duke fits that model. Now, whether that's a working model going forward or not, and Wisconsin just doesn't. They're not great on defense, and they also really have no point guard that you're going to say is going to play at the NBA level.
Right, and the guards were really what tore up Wisconsin last night. And we should note, thank you, Kate, for making the first mention of KenPom on this podcast. It would not be a podcast about a hot takedown about college basketball without at least throwing some money in the KenPom tip jar, which we did over the weekend with you guys as well.
The streak is still alive.
Yes. One of the things that was interesting about the game was sort of watching Jahlil Okafor and Frank Kaminsky square off, and it seemed in the stadium, at least, like that, like every time, and this is a real unsupported assertion, but every time that Okafor or Kaminsky got the ball, there was a bit of extra tension in the air, because the question was who was going to, like, which rock was going to beat which rock at rock, paper, scissors, because they're somewhat similar players. Kaminsky probably has a little more range, and it seemed to me like Kaminsky totally got the best of Okafor in that game.
Yeah, statistically, he averaged more points per possession. Okafor had a slightly larger offensive workload, but I think it's tough to argue that Okafor, between also the fouls, he only played 22 minutes, that Kaminsky didn't have a much better game. And maybe that tells us that we were sort of looking in the wrong place, barking up the wrong tree going into the game, because we did think that it would come down to that matchup at center. But really, like you said, Kate, it came down to Duke's guards vastly outplaying Wisconsin's guards.
Yeah, and when Okafor went out of the game with that fourth foul, it was 9:18 left in the game. He was out until just over 3 minutes. And Duke's offense, they went right to Jones. They went to all on-ball screens because they didn't have to worry about dumping it down low where Okafor and Kaminsky were battling. And they had Jones with the ball, and he completely took over. As well as Grayson Allen, who was incredible in that game, a guy that we didn't even really see produce much throughout the tournament. And, of course, Okafor comes back in, and from, like, 3 minutes to 2 minutes, he made a number of plays that contributed to Duke getting that, like, slight margin that they were able to hold on to. But it really was Tyus Jones, who's the guy that we weren't, I mean, he's a great player, but we weren't talking about him as like that trio of Duke one and done. And now maybe, you know, it depends what he does, of course, but he seemed like he was the best freshman on the court.
Yeah, and you talk about that stretch where Okafor sat out. If you look at the win probability graph of the game, you would think that that would be a great time for Wisconsin to improve their chances, and they were already around like 70-75% at that time when he came out. That was the time in which they lost the most from their win probability of the entire game. It falls off a cliff at that point. And it's really, like you said, it's only explained by the fact that Grayson Allen and Tyus Jones just took the game over, essentially, that Wisconsin had no defense against them.
And so what's interesting about thinking about single games, especially when you think about it within the empirical data, whatever lens that we often do at 538, is how much stock are we supposed to put in this one game? I mean, part of the thrill of sports is that unpredictable things can happen. And part of the limitation, I think, of the empirical approach is like, when you try and make sense of the game last night, all you can make sense of it is what happened vis-a-vis expectation, as you said, Neil, earlier. And so, to me, I sort of, in these moments of the Super Bowl was similar, and in these moments of sort of one game is all that matters, I throw this empirical stuff out the window, and I just sort of watch amazing sports and athletics happen. Am I wrong to do that? Am I thinking about it the wrong way?
No, I don't think so. I think that's almost the whole way that you have to approach it now, especially since we know a lot more about the role of chance in games. Ken Pomeroy, we talked about him and his rankings.
Another quarter in
that tip jar. Yep, got to drop another one in. Wisconsin still ranks higher than Duke, even after taking into account last night's game. And Kentucky and Arizona rank higher than either team. So you can make the case that if Ken Pomeroy is the most predictive model, or perhaps the one here at 538 even, I think it would have similar rankings. Certainly Kentucky would be favored even in Vegas if they were to play any of the aforementioned teams tomorrow, that, you know, it's a one and done game, and in any kind of single elimination tournament, variance happens. So as a fan, I think you have to kind of separate yourself from, we're not trying to pick the best team here. This is not an experiment designed to prove who the best team is. Duke might have been the best team. Kentucky might have been the best team. Really, we're just trying to determine who the winner of the 2015 NCAA championship is, and that's a totally separate thing.
And those winners, though, build into legacies very quickly. So in this case, Coach K got his fifth national championship, and maybe it was just because Grayson Allen saved him, and that was a 10% probability of something that might happen. But as a result, Kate, we're going to talk about Coach K like he... like I heard last night on SportsCenter, is perhaps better than any other coach who's ever coached in college basketball.
Except Izzo.
Right.
Except Izzo. Yeah, and I think that what plays into the storyline, too, going into the game Wisconsin-Duke, is did Wisconsin spend all of their energy beating Kentucky? That's not something, a question we would ask ourselves going into a seven-game NBA series, you know, if it's like Spurs against the Memphis Grizzlies, right? There's such a way to analyze that data-wise, and you know, of course, anything can happen in seven-game series, but fewer variables than we see in the NCAA tournament. In addition, like all of the sports writers that I was talking to and hearing about yesterday, they wanted to know from the Wisconsin players, how much of an emotional high was winning that game against Kentucky, and does that affect you going into the game against Duke? And I don't know what kind of statistics exist to even verify that, but I know as an athlete, that is something, despite Wisconsin saying repeatedly, no, 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 it had nothing to do with it, there is something to the emotional output you give, as well as the physical output, and doing something incredible and having a moment that probably felt like a national championship, and media and people respond to it like it's a national championship, and then having to go out the next day, and well, 2 days later, and like play another game. I don't, you know, you saw like Miracle on Ice in 1980, that huge win against Russia. Like nobody talks about the fact that then the U.S. team had to go and beat Finland. And I'm sure we have tons of examples where the penultimate game is an amazing moment. And how often does the team then turn around and succeed in the actual legitimate title game?
So I don't know if I buy into that, Kate, although there were some Wisconsin fans who were saying something similar when Jody talked to them, that they were wondering if it was a letdown game. And I made a joke on the emergency pod over the weekend that this was a classic trap game for Wisconsin. But the thing is, and I think what I'm about to say, I should say, I think pro athletes are unaffected by the emotional psychological aspects of sports, probably a little more. And this is unfounded, but they're older. They've been through it more times. There's more reps, what have you. But if three Sam Decker shots go in, and Wisconsin wins by 3 points, and they don't give up the 9-point lead in the second half, then this conversation that we're having right now doesn't happen about whether it was a letdown game. That seems to me like it was chance. I mean, Wisconsin didn't look flat. They looked like they were competing. And so, Niels, it's just a matter of us sort of trying to assign maybe narrative post facto, or could there be something to it because we can't really quite measure psychology?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we can't really quantify. So it's entirely possible, and I would take the players' word for it. I mean, they're the ones that are going out there and feeling these things. I worry about some of the narratives that get built by, you know, sports writers and talking heads after the fact, because it is really easy to say if Wisconsin wins that, you know, we're not having this conversation. It's kind of a post hoc narrative that the temptation can be to generate.
Kate, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I'm always wary of, right, like, ifs. It's like, well, if Sam Decker had shot well, and he didn't, and Wisconsin did lose this game, and it could be like a sports writer thing or an athlete thing, having been through really amazing wins, like we won a game over Stanford to get from the Sweet 16 to the Elite Eight. The follow-up game was really, really difficult emotionally and mentally. I would have never said that at the time to anybody, you know, like certainly not the media. You're never going to say, yeah, you know, it was really tough to get back up for this next game. You're always going to say we were fine. That had nothing to do with it. I think, like, I just look at it like, what if Wisconsin had played Michigan State in the semis and then met up with Duke, who'd beaten Kentucky in the finals? Like, does that change anything about their emotional reservoir that they have to tap into? And it's a dangerous place to go because there really is no way to answer that question.
And to the question, or to the idea that maybe players aren't telling the media all that they feel, I was in the room last night when both players of both teams were up on the podium, on the stage, sort of answering these very hackneyed questions, not necessarily through the fault of the journalists. Like, there's not much you can ask after the game's over that really gets at any real insight or truth of the matter. But Wisconsin brought out Josh Gasser and Frank Kaminsky and Bo Ryan. And Frank Kaminsky looked even more long in the face than he usually does. And he was, I mean, he couldn't speak. He was so beside himself. And so these game stories get written based on quotes that happen, you know, 30 to 60 minutes after the game is over in the locker room or in press conferences or whatever else. And human beings can't process trauma that quickly. And this is traumatic. I mean, Frank Kaminsky played his last game as a Badger. He'd been there for 4 years. And now he's supposed to sum up perhaps why he lost or why he didn't go harder against Okafor in the last 5 minutes. I mean, it's almost impossible to get your head around when we're outside of it, but let alone inside of it.
And that's what I really like. NFL coaches often say, like, well, we'll have to look at the tape. Like, we won't know certain things, even though we were in the game and experienced it sort of in real time. We won't know a lot about who played well or what the key plays were until we broke down the game tape days afterward.
Also, from a writer storytelling perspective, I'm always excited when I hear like oral histories coming out 5 years after, 7 years after, because once you put that emotional distance, oftentimes you'll hear like the very true, real story of a moment or a game when players are no longer worried about if they say something in a moment or even what the moment meant to them. So you're totally right. Like, to ask them to process it and to be able to process it right after is really, really difficult. And sometimes it's only until you get people together with enough distance in it that you're like, here's the real, or as close as you can get to the truth, here's the real truth about like what we felt during that game.
Right, and in tennis, they have to stand out in front of the whole crowd when they lose and talk to the whole stadium about their feelings. But interestingly, Kate, I do think when these oral histories come out, they're sort of... There's a working hypothesis that history goes by based on what happens right after the game. And the oral history is sort of shaded by that a little bit, even 5 years later. You know, like there's a sort of set narrative that still trickles down however long and then is sort of the baseline that we build our later legacies upon. So congrats again to Duke and its fans, but let's dwell one more second on Kentucky, because we talked about them so much on Hot Takedown. They lost a thriller to Wisconsin on Saturday night, as we've mentioned, ending their run at a perfect season. And when that happened, were you guys shocked? What were you thinking?
I wouldn't call it shocked. Our model, our own model, which had Kentucky very high throughout the entire process, still gave Wisconsin, what, a 31% chance of winning that game? So
that Kentucky would lose most of the time in one of the two remaining games. 49%.
Right, yeah. Yeah, they had less than a 50% chance of running the table, even when they only had to win two more games to run the table. So the odds of going undefeated, they compound because you multiply the probabilities together. So, yeah, I wouldn't say I was shocked that they lost.
Yeah, I think if I had been, you know, the day before thinking about Kentucky losing, probably would have shocked me, but it was interesting watching the game as you saw the plays Wisconsin was making and the struggles you saw Kentucky have that maybe they had never had before in the season. It felt like not as surprising as I thought it would be, you know, leading into it. I think you could see how the model was completely accurate, right? Kentucky runs into a Wisconsin team where certain guys are playing above average, and their offensive efficiency is exactly what they say it's going to be. And Kentucky, instead of being perfect down the stretch like they had to be against Notre Dame, made some mistakes, missed some shots. So I wasn't in the moment as surprised as I thought I might be going into it.
And I think that's really interesting, Kate. You talked about not being able to visualize it until afterward when it seemed perfectly logical, because with a team like Kentucky, no one had seen this Kentucky team lose. So in a certain sense, it was impossible to visualize what that looked like. But we all know that, you know, had a few bounces gone the other way, they could have lost to Ole Miss. They could have lost several times throughout
the
season.
Texas A&M went to double overtime.
Exactly. So there were games like a loss. But again, I think it's human nature to not be able to envision something that, you know, hasn't happened yet until it does actually happen.
So Jody, in his quest to talk to some of the saddest people on earth, also talked to Kentucky fans as they were filing out of the stadium, and he got some more hot takes immediately after the loss.
God, it's just the worst thing I've ever seen, getting beat tonight. I'm in shock, really.
Well, it was back and forth pretty good, and I think when Kentucky had the lead, like with 4 points, and all of a sudden they started slowing it down and taking it down, and they had three consecutive shot clock violations, and then all of a sudden we lost the momentum, plus we didn't score. And against a team like with Wisconsin, you just can't do that because they're gonna come back on it, and that's what happened. I think if we'd have kept on attacking like we had been, that's how we got our 4-point lead, I think we'd have been in good shape.
Like, what's your take? What went wrong?
Wisconsin beat us.
It's pretty straightforward. Want to elaborate?
Well, they played better than we did. I don't think we took them seriously enough, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, sorry, say that again.
I'm heartbroken. It's going to be the year for us.
But what happened in terms of the game? I mean, what's your take on what went wrong?
I don't want to blame the officiating, but boy, it really knocked us hard. It knocked us hard.
Did that last person have a point? Did the officiating doom Kentucky? In particular, I'm interested in the lack of a shot clock violation that was called with 2 minutes and 30 seconds left when Nigel Hayes was driving baseline, and he sort of shot it, got his own rebound somehow, and then shot it back up again. It seemed like on that second shot, it was almost, I think it's incontrovertible, that that was too late. And because it wasn't reviewable, there was no call made. And then also we saw in the Wisconsin-Duke game another call that seemed to go the wrong way, where the ball brushed off of Justice Winslow's fingers as it went out of bounds late in the game. But that was called that it was off Wisconsin, and so Duke got the ball. And my question is whether we think one possession is enough to swing a game, because that's what a fan thinks about when they feel slighted or that there's an injustice done. Could it be that in either of those games, that one possession was enough to make the other team win?
Well, definitely. I mean, when there's a close game like that, again, going back to the win probability charts, Wisconsin's win probability after that particular, after they scored following that, went up by 25%. And it was around 50%, you know, throughout that whole sequence. So, yeah, that was a crucial play in the game. But you can find any close game and you'll find possessions that are really important if they go one way or the other. Kentucky, and our boss Nate Silver wrote about this, they also just did a bunch of things strategically that may have doomed them, and they shouldn't have been in a position where one possession could have cost them the game, you know, on an official's poor call.
Kate, when you were playing, did getting slighted by the refs, did that affect your performance at all or the team's performance? And, you know, do you think there's a psychological element to that?
That's an interesting question, because I think in moments, you can feel that way, but now when I think back on it, I can't remember at any point. Like, overall, my overall feeling has always been that things even out, right? And then that's always my gut reaction, even in listening to the Kentucky fan and to talking about the refereeing in a game. Even across, like, the 40 minutes of a game, I usually feel like you could point to calls in both directions, and I always have a general sense of, okay, overall, that was a fairly called game. And it's a very rare occurrence where I'm like, I think the refs, you know, hurt this team or, you know, hurt certainly Kentucky in that example. And I always, there's always the storyline, right, that Duke gets more calls than any other team. And we were talking about that a couple weeks ago on Around the Horn. And if you actually look at, like, you know, the foul shots Duke has taken, like, every year over the last 5 years, like, they've never even been in, like, the top 10 in terms of foul shots taken. So that always has struck me as a storyline, but is not actually a rational reason for the outcome.
All right, so let's close our conversation in the men's tournament. A reminder that we'll come back tomorrow on Hot Takedown to talk about an emergency pod, talk about the women's final and the presuming coronation of UConn. And, you know, I think we should all thank Ken Pomeroy one more time for giving so much good foundational work for our men's college tournament.
It wouldn't
Thanks,
be the
Ken.
Same without him.
And so before we go talk baseball in 1 second, a word from our sponsor. All of 538's March Madness coverage brought to you by Acura. The Acura ILX is quick off the line with a 201-horsepower, 2.4-liter iVTEC engine. With an 8-speed dual-clutch transmission, the 2016 ILX delivers rapid and smooth shifts while instantly reacting to your every move. Witness the quickness for yourself. Go to Acura.com/ILX or head to your nearest Acura dealership for a test drive. The 2016 Acura ILX. Catch it if you can. Okay, guys, time to talk about baseball again. And let the record show, it was Kate's idea to talk about baseball this week. Kate, what came over you?
It was my idea to talk about Matt Harvey.
Oh,
and then other baseball topics got tagged onto that.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
So you're saying we backdoored our way. Okay. All right. Well,
exactly.
So we're going to get to Harvey, but we're also going to talk about sort of what it is that we should think about opening days and early returns in baseball. But before we do, I want to talk about something that happened before opening day. And the Padres completed what may have been one of the crazier off seasons that we've seen, with one last trade. And so they got Craig Kimbrel and Marvin
Upton Jr.
Name change. So they got Kimbrel and Upton, one of the Upton brothers, for Cameron Maybin, Carlos Quentin, and some prospects. And the prospects were really what the Braves got in that deal. And so let's hear what some anonymous takes from around the league are saying. And this is from Buster Olney on the Baseball Tonight podcast.
Let me tell you something. The consensus is as strong as I've ever seen it for any trade. People with other teams, these are executives, were killing this trade from the Padres' end. They thought it was a dramatic overpay to get Kimbrel, and they don't really know if it actually makes them that much better.
So did it make them better, Neil? Are the Padres a contender now, as I'm sure they would argue that Kimbrel completed their bullpen and whatever else? Or was this mortgaging too much of the future for too little payoff in the present?
Well, it probably is anytime you trade for a relief pitcher like this. But the Padres, it bears mentioning that it's part of this pattern of moves that they made over the entire offseason where they brought in a bunch of new guys, and you know, both Uptons, Will Myers. They brought in Matt Kemp and the rest of his contract. Some of it is being paid by the Dodgers.
He takes up two seats on an airplane because of the contract.
That's right. So in a conjunction with all of those moves, the Padres Padres have improved probably as much as any team since the end of last season, but it also bears questioning why, like, what's the point? They've clearly put all their cards down on the table, but they're in the same division with the Dodgers, who are regarded as the best team in baseball, or one of the best teams, certainly in the National League. It's unlikely that they'll win the division. And so if you don't win the division in Major League Baseball, now you get thrown into this one-game playoff where you have to play your way in. It's much more difficult for wildcard teams than it used to be just a few years ago before they changed the format. So it's kind of a strange case of timing for the Padres to decide to go all in at this very moment, especially with some of the players they did. And Kimbrel is great. Some of the other ones, like we mentioned, Kemp, he played great in the second half last year. But before that, he had had two, you know, kind of off seasons.
With injuries, yeah.
Injury-plagued seasons, but not the kinds of injuries that you would expect to get better, like an arthritic hip. So, you know, and picking up Will Myers was a great move, in my opinion, because he is, you know, looked like a star in the making since he was in the minors and even as a rookie a couple years ago with Tampa. But, there's an idea of a success cycle where you sort of build up and gradually try to make your move at the right time, even taking into account the other teams around you and your chances to sort of maximize your return in the playoffs, which, as we know, is kind of random, but you can make it less random in today's format by winning your division. And the Padres, you know, seem to have decided to go all in at a time in which they have a really strong team in their same division.
Kate, does that success cycle sound familiar in any other sports, or is it sort of native to baseball or unique to baseball? It seems to me like in other sports, because the playoffs, in the NBA, for example, because the playoffs are open to more teams and each team has a fair shot, aside from the seedings, when the playoffs start, that you don't need to worry about timing your rise in the same way. It's not like a team's going to wait for LeBron James to leave the Eastern Conference or something like that. Whereas, as Neil's saying, the Padres maybe are timing their rise at the wrong point, given the Dodgers' strength.
My perspective on that would be, like, you can only worry about, like, putting together the best roster you can put together because of so many different variables that take place over the course of a baseball season, as well as, like, all kinds of injuries that can happen. So it seems like it would be an impossibility to ask a baseball GM to not only manage their own roster, but also, in essence, place that roster against, like, whatever teams are also rising at the same time. I think it's the difficult part for me is like the one game play-in, right? Because then you're statistically, you're kind of putting yourself in a position where no matter what you did over the course of such a long season, you're caught in this only this one, much like March Madness, where everything goes out the window. But if I were a fan of the Padres and I saw, you know, I saw one guy comment, like, does the Padres owner only have 8 months to live? I mean, really, like, what he's doing is, like, it makes it seem like it's, like, now or never, like, this is our year. But if I'm a Padres fan, I'm like, all right, we pick up a few extra wins now that we've got the best closer, one of the best closers in baseball. Like, our likelihood to possibly win the World Series has increased. Like, I want that stuff.
I like imagining the Padres front office as the record label on Empire, where there's a guy in charge who's just trying to make sure that his legacy is preserved and see as much fun as possible. So on the opening day, speaking of one-game playoffs or one-game small sample size, on opening day the Padres lost 6-3, but Matt Kemp went 2-for-4. Drove in 3 runs. Must have been a good pickup, right?
He's going to have a great year.
That's right. And so, you know, there's a temptation in baseball, especially where it's such a long season, to find storylines as immediately as possible because I love baseball, but it is a slow game and things are very slow to accumulate as far as any sort of real statistical insight or real insight into what's happening on a team in general. And our colleague Ben Castleman was listening to the Red Sox game yesterday, and he said that the radio announcers on WEI, I believe, were divining things about Clay Buchholz, the starter for the Red Sox, after only 3 pitches. They said that they were looking at those 3 pitches and saying that Buchholz really looked, you know, looked better this year. He like was back to his old form or something like that. And that didn't exactly – or no, it did shake out. He pitched a shutout over I don't know how many innings. And also I saw when my daily check-in with the Mets, whom, again, I love and hate, or I hate how much I love them, rather. There was a headline that said, after the Mets beat the Nats 3-1 on Monday, that the headline said, gritty win could turn tide for Mets. That one game could turn a tide, and I guess the tide is, you know, nearly a decade of misery. And so what's a thinking van supposed to do? Like, when are we supposed to trust what comes in the baseball season?
Well, so I did a study last year where I looked at where in the season a team's record is 50% luck and 50% skill. And that comes around 67 games where your half of what you see is still going to be variance that just naturally happens when, you know, you have so, the standings don't reflect a team's true talent necessarily. And also it's kind of a series of coin flips in a certain way because it's, you know, you either win or lose. So beyond just your players sync up and have like great years above their projections or below, that would show up in your run differential, but then translating that into wins and losses is like another step removed where we can see teams have luck beyond what their runs and runs scored and allowed say they should have had.
So if I'm if you're a Phillies fan.
I am.
What you're saying is you're going to wait how long until you sort of know that the Phillies are exactly as bad as they appear to be?
For teams that are at the extremes, I think when you see results that perhaps confirm what you've already suspected, for instance, that the Phillies are terrible, which we saw some confirming evidence yesterday, that it probably doesn't take as long to change your opinion. You would need a lot of evidence, probably more than the 67 games into the season, if the Phillies started playing really well and you're prior, as we like to say in Bayesian stats, is that they're bad.
Put a quarter in the Bayesian tip jar, Neil.
I know. Him and Ken Pomeroy share it. So, yeah, you would have to sort of wait even longer to trust that the Phillies were for real. Whereas if it were a team like the Dodgers, then you wouldn't have to wait as long. Perhaps less than 67 games worth of good play from the Dodgers would kind of confirm your belief, oh, they're a good team.
Right, and we dress this up in like Bayesian thinking or whatever. It's just conventional wisdom a little bit, which is that if the thought is the Dodgers are going to be good and the Dodgers have a good first month, then probably the Dodgers are as good as we thought they might be. And so one of the pitchers not pitching on opening day is Kate's boy, Matt Harvey. And so Harvey was sort of held back in the rotation, perhaps so that he had made fewer starts. The Mets have said that They're gonna have a plan for Matt Harvey, and that plan includes innings limits and pitch limits, probably, but they won't say exactly what to the public for reasons that are unclear. And Terry Collins, the Mets manager, said, quote, "We'll take care of him. We're going to be delicate." And Kate, you had a question about whether we should be delicate with pitchers who come back from surgery, right?
Yeah, I did. I think that could be because I'm looking at it through like the lens of basketball, which in a lot of ways, the injuries that guys and women sustain in basketball, sort of like a one moment type injury. And even when you're coming back from another injury or worried about aggravating the same injury, it's really not a matter of how many minutes you're playing, but it's a matter of, are you put in the wrong position? Does a jump stop go wrong? You know, so it's almost like it doesn't make logical sense at times, and certainly there are exceptions, but at times it doesn't make sense to limit a player's minute because it's almost like it's like a game of chance. Oh, did I limit the right minute, or is he gonna, you know, go up off one foot, you know, for a dunk and pop his knee in that minute? So when I apply that framework to basketball, and we've seen it with Derrick Rose at times when he was, you know, he had more than enough time to come back from his second injury, the meniscus tear, and then they're limiting his minutes, and you're kind of like, well, why are they doing that if he's fully healed? But I do understand, like, so that's my question a little bit. Like, I know with Harvey, part of my concern with him is, like, he's a guy who wanted to come back from this Tommy John surgery, like, at the end of last year, like, far too soon. He seems to have this gung-ho mentality, which, as a Mets fan growing up, and I guess I can still call myself a Mets fan, I worry that even if he was hurting a little bit or if he was sore, if he felt a twinge, I'm concerned that he wouldn't even flag it for the team doctors and be like, hey, I'm feeling this, because he hasn't been on the mound in so long and he wants to contribute. So I can see them like being proactive about forcing him to pitch fewer innings. But I didn't know if there's any correlation between if we limit Matt Harvey's innings, is it less likely that he's going to have some sort of like pull or like, you know, fall, like have an injury again? Or is it like, how does that work specifically for the Tommy John surgery?
Yeah, so the trick with as you said, with baseball injuries is that it's sort of accrued stress over time, especially for pitchers, where the act of throwing the pitch is an anatomically incorrect act, basically, especially when repeated with such strength over and over again. And based on the reading that I've done, it is we know that inning limits do help, and Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, for pitchers in general. That pitchers, especially not inning limits, excuse me, that having a regimen where you don't overstress an arm. And one of the worries with Harvey is that he's such a psychopath that he won't say, "Take me out, my arm's hurting." And so perhaps the Mets are putting this innings limit on it on him as a result to sort of have a hard and fast rule. Now the trick is that based on talking to 538's baseball columnist Rob Arthur, what we don't know, what there's no data on, is how people coming back from surgery should be treated. Do innings limits help any more or less for if you've already had Tommy John surgery than if you're hopefully trying to not get Tommy John surgery in the first place?
Yeah, the research from Russell Carlton, who is a great writer for Baseball Prospectus, he did a piece a few years ago where he looked at, do innings limits even help? And the conventional wisdom, or at least the smart take, I think, especially when Steven Strasburg was famously put on this innings limit and it resulted in him not being able to pitch in the playoffs for the Nationals a few years ago, was that, well, this is silly. Innings aren't what we should be measuring anyway. We should be measuring pitches, but it's not even clear if pitcher abuse is still sort of a valid concept where you track, you know, the cumulative damage done or the high pitch outings to try to see if a pitcher has been put under extreme duress, basically, in some of his starts. And so he looked at trying to account for a player's existing injury history, and he found that that was significant. So one of the best, or perhaps the best predictor of whether a pitcher will get injured again is, has he been injured before, which is sort of bad news for Matt Harvey because he fits that group. It's almost like you take a pitcher once they become injured, particularly with a shoulder or an elbow injury, you put them in another entire like species of pitcher. They are set apart, and they're always going to be an injury risk. But then he also looked at innings limits versus pitch limits versus batter's face limits. And interestingly, the inning itself was significant. And when you included innings, pitches and batter's face weren't. And that lent him to believe that perhaps there was something not to just the number of pitches that you're throwing, but this act of, think about what goes into an inning. You warm up a few times, you throw a series of really high stress pitches, then you stop, you sit in the dugout for a few minutes, and then you come back in and you do it again. So perhaps it's the finding that the innings limit itself was significant is that this act of not only unnaturally throwing a ball with such velocity, but doing it in the manner in which pitchers have to do it, where they alternate between just sitting and doing nothing and watching the action and then going out and doing it, that is what causes these overuse injuries, on top of just the fact that pitchers, you know, have never been a durable type of baseball player. And that's been true since the beginning.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting because, you know, there are a lot of people who work out now based on, like, high-intensity intervals, because the whole theory is that it's more difficult for the human body to, you know, get its heart rate up to 160 and then come back down and then get it up to 160 again than it is, say, to just chill at 140 for 40 minutes. So you can see why a player having to, inning-wise, for a pitcher being really crucial, because you're of the rev up and then rev down and then the rev up again. That's just something that is very taxing on the human body.
So, Kate, you just gave me a great idea for a new hot takedown segment about CrossFit, which we should absolutely talk about. But let's leave the baseball stuff there, because it's time for the first time on Hot Takedown. Well, no, we talked about hockey last week, I guess, in Significant Digit. But the first time, talk about the NHL. And we're going to bring in a professor from Skidmore, Mike Lopez, to talk about a piece he wrote recently for 538 about why NHL teams stop trying to win in the third period when they're tied. The way that hockey teams play has been radically affected by the way that the NHL rewards points at the ends of games. And Mike, welcome to Hot Takedown, first of all. Hi, Mike.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
And so, Mike, if you could sum up your research for those who haven't read the piece in, you know, 30, 60 seconds, you know, what did you find?
Well, so there are a couple things. The first major thing is that teams, because the league incentives award 3 points for games that are decided in overtime or the shootout, but only 2 for those that are decided in regulation, there's an extra incentive to play overtime. And so that manifests itself in the final 5 minutes of regulation, because when the teams are tied, what we found is that they stop aggressively trying to score. And they sit back, they take a defensive approach. We have some coaches and players that sort of agree with this, that they change their strategy. And the idea is that they take a passive approach, they'll get to overtime, and when they get to overtime, each team is guaranteed at least 1 point.
So that 3 points, that's for both teams combined, right?
Yep, 3 points for each team combined. And then the sort of the silly thing about the system is that an overtime or a shootout win counts the same as a regulation win. And so a regulation win is 2 points. If you win it on the shootout, you're also getting the same 2 points. So because each team can still reach that 2 points for the win by going to overtime, and you guarantee yourself a point by going to overtime, even if you lose, there's that extra incentive.
One of the amazing things was that the teams really did admit that they were doing this. And I guess it makes sense because they're trying to maximize their ability to make the playoffs. But what was it? A Ducks coach, an Anaheim Ducks coach, said that they...
We had a Ducks player and a Washington Capitals coach. It was interesting. We looked at, when we first had this idea, we looked at what teams are playing overtime more often and figured that we'd start with them. And when we started that in early February, Washington and Anaheim were two of the teams that had played the most frequent overtime games. And it didn't take long. It wasn't like we had to call a bunch of coaches and a bunch of players to try and get them on record to say this. You know, they were very willing to talk about it. One of the defender we got for the Ducks, was very happy to admit that, you know, strategy has changed. You play in a couple different point systems, and suddenly you're now in one where there's this extra incentive for overtime, and coaches are smart enough to make those changes.
And interestingly, as the season goes on, the teams start doing it even more. And so it looks like, based on your research, a game is 20% more likely to go into overtime 150 games into the season than in this new system than it was in the old system. Whereas as you get into the middle of the season, the likelihood of overtime is much closer. And so what's the thinking there as the season comes to an end, Mike?
The assumption is that teams are even more desperate for a point at this time of the year. There's more pressure from fans. There's more pressure from the team officials to get that extra point in order to make sure that you're in as good of a position as you can, either to make the playoffs or to get the best seed that you can.
And Kate,
yeah, and actually, you know, I thought it was really interesting. I mean, I watch hockey, so I already knew this, but it's really fascinating that certain games are worth more points than other games. And, you know, in most sports with point systems, like the Premier League, for example, there are also no, like, divisions and conferences where you're going for seeding, or you're more worried about a divisional opponent, and therefore that even skews trying to, like, hang a zero on a divisional opponent and changes incentives for how you play within divisions and conferences versus you might an opponent, you know, in a division not your own, which I found really interesting. Did you notice that at all?
I think the league itself is probably okay with more games going to overtime. The sense I get is that I can't imagine that they'd be happy that teams are extra passive when they're playing teams from the other conference. And that's both in a higher fraction of overtime games, and it's also in more passive behavior, fewer goals scored, fewer shots, fewer expected goals scored in the final minutes of tied games. And like Kate, you said, that there's different incentives based on the opponent that you play. When you're playing a team that you might be competing against for a playoff spot, it matters that you're giving them a point. Tonight's a perfect example. Pittsburgh's playing Ottawa. If Ottawa plays for a tie, well, Ottawa might actually lose out to Pittsburgh in the seedings for the playoffs. And so because of that, it might be in Ottawa's best interest to prevent Pittsburgh from getting a tie. Whereas if Ottawa's playing, say, Vancouver or a team from the Western Conference, Ottawa is perfectly happy to go to overtime because Ottawa doesn't care if that other team gets a point.
So do you think this is a situation where the league would almost be best served to have two different point systems depending on whether it's an in-conference or out-of-conference game?
I think the easiest system is just any structure where the total share of points awarded is identical for regulation games and overtime games. Whether that's a 3-2-1-0, whether it's the proposal from Nate Silver, which is to just count every game as a 2 or a 0, anything where the total share of points awarded is the same, and I think you'll start to see teams behaving the same no matter what the game is, and also perhaps fighting a little bit harder at the end of regulation to try and actually win the game.
You know, from a fan perspective, I wonder what people truly feel about so many overtime games, and this is kind of like more personal, but I like to think of overtime as like a very special moment, whether you go to a game as a fan and you get overtime, or you're watching a game at home and you're like, oh my God, yes, we got overtime. It doesn't sound like the NHL is all that concerned that they're taking away sort of the sanctity of what it means to be an overtime game, does it?
I think you're probably right. I mean, we were able to catch up with the president of the Calgary Flames, Brian Burke, at the Sloan Conference, and we asked him. He's one of the he's one of the big leagues in terms of somebody that would be able to implement change in the league. And I know roughly a decade ago they considered alternative point systems, and they looked at it. They said this isn't for us. And one of the points he made, which is in addition to the fact that overtime is entertaining, is that it creates this sort of artificial set of parity in league standings where teams appear to be really close, and that potentially creates more fan interest, right? If you're a fan of a team and you look at the standings and they're 30 points behind, well, it doesn't matter what the scoring system is. You're going to sort of feel like they don't have a chance to catch up. Whereas in the current system, maybe they're only 10 points behind, and you might have this sort of inflated sense that, oh, yeah, my team can actually catch up to the team in front, and then sort of that increases your interest in the game.
Now, you've done a little research on how this has impacted this season's standings, right? Which teams are sort of rising and falling on the basis of the NHL's current point system versus the alternative that you proposed?
Sure. Well, it's a really interesting situation out west. So two of the teams that are fighting for the last playoff spot in the Western Conference are Winnipeg and Los Angeles. So Los Angeles, sort of the old guard, Stanley Cup champs. Winnipeg, a little bit more of an upstart and a little bit more of a surprise. Winnipeg played the highest number of overtime games this year, and in fact is doing as well as LA in the standings in terms of total points, despite the fact that Winnipeg has six fewer regulation wins than LA. And in fact, LA's number of regulation wins is the highest in the Western Conference. If you look at the number of regulation wins of all Western Conference teams, it's the LA Kings, one, tied with Chicago and tied with Minnesota. There's a chance that one of those teams with the highest number of regulation wins actually misses the playoffs. And the reason that they would miss the playoffs is because Winnipeg has played a much larger share of overtime games and has received more of the so-called loser point than the Kings have.
And I would imagine that the regulation wins are probably more correlated with actual team skill than the overtime wins and the shootout wins.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I think when you talk about I'm not sure I'm going to call it the best predictor because I haven't done any analysis myself in terms of predicting playoff success. But in terms of judging regular season success, mm-hmm. certainly a regulation win means more or should mean more than either an overtime win or a shootout win.
Great. So, Mike, thanks for coming on and talking to us about this. You can find Mike's article on 538.com. We post links to what we talk about in each Hot Takedown on the Hot Takedown page on 538, and so you'll be able to find a link to Mike and Noah's piece there. Mike, thanks again.
All right. Awesome. Thanks so much.
And now, as always, with our significant digit of the week, Allison McCann huddled in the same hotel room in Tampa because both Kate and Allison are in Tampa to cover the Women's Final Four. They're huddled around an iPhone 6 Plus, my sources tell me. Allison, thanks again for coming to the show.
Hey, Chad. This week, I'm bringing 7,500, which I think is our largest significant digit to date, which are the number of tickets that the Houston Dash are short of their goal for Friday's game. It's the home opener of the National Women's Soccer League, and they had shot for selling 10,000 tickets. And as of the end of last week, They were far shy of that at only around 2,500. And I think this is just super interesting. This is the third season of the third attempt at a women's professional soccer league in the U.S. And, you know, I guess it might sound sort of not so great to hear that, but the league average was around 4,000 tickets. They were at 2,500. They'll probably get there. This is sort of normal, and yet they had set this really lofty goal for selling 10,000. And there's a few exceptions of teams in Portland and Kansas City that have, you know, got up to 15,000, 20,000 fans at some of their games. But I do think it's really interesting, particularly for this year, in trying to make the league get through this ominous third season, and especially given that this is a World Cup year, and a lot of our big-name players won't be playing in the domestic league. And, so I'm bringing this significant digit and just trying to see what you guys think of how can a league continue to draw interest with missing some of these big players and also just continue to grow a women's professional soccer league in the U.S.
I think the World Cup conundrum is kind of interesting because normally you would think that an event like that would draw attention to the domestic league as a side effect. People get into it when they see the U.S. team play, and then they're like, oh, I want to see more of this. But you're saying that it actually kind of hurts the attendance because all of the stars are missing from this league.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of twofold. Like, a big seller for these games have been, hey, come see Abby Wambach, come see Alex Morgan, you know, some of the best players in the world. That obviously sells a ton of tickets. But then on the flip side, like you said, Neil, like so much more interest will just be in general surrounding women's soccer. And so it sort of it goes both ways. Like these teams need to draw attention to the fact that they're playing and that you won't see sort of some of these big names, but you might see, you know, other growing new players that might be in the next World Cup and are really exciting to look for. So I think it's just sort of an interesting, yeah, going both ways.
So, Allison, you've done some reporting around women's soccer in Sweden, right? And I wonder what the attendance figures are like abroad for women's soccer leagues.
It definitely depends. So Sweden is one of the strongest leagues, and I think they probably would get closer to, you know, in the 10,000 range, but still nothing that the U.S. hasn't seen. But, again, all of the European leagues are on the same schedule as the men, which break during the summer for a World Cup, for an Olympics, and the American League is not on that same time schedule, so sort of runs into this conflict, which is more unique to us.
Yeah, and I think in reading about this, what I noticed was that because the Dash were at 2,500 and they had this lofty goal of 10,000, they brought in a few of their players to make calls to former season ticket holders or anybody whose phone numbers they had where they could have a midfielder or a defenseman call and actually pitch the team and tell their stories one-to-one, which, of course, is what you need in sports. You need people to understand the stories. And in men's sports, those are delivered through newspapers back in the day and now, you know, mobile and of course, through Hot Takedown. And now the Dash have these players telling their stories one-on-one to try and sell tickets. And I think for this league, you know, there's that ominous third year for women's soccer, but of course this league is a little different because it has the backbone of the U.S. soccer, Canadian national soccer, and the Mexican national soccer team, which are all paying the salaries of their national team members, which is a significant portion of players and certainly of star players. And that's very similar to the WNBA when it launched, having the backing of the NBA so that as it hit these ruts, and the WNBA certainly did in its first few years as certain franchises folded or moved and they kind of settled on what the core numbers should be, they had the financial backing of a larger entity which would keep it from folding. So it's like numbers like this are interesting because you worry about women's soccer, but I do think this is a slightly different situation in the financial support it has, but of course that's not going to carry it forever and ever. It's like the Dash are going to have to find out a way to get those numbers up higher because U.S. soccer is not just going to keep throwing money into an empty pit.
The league has, like in the previous two leagues, teams had folded by the third season. We haven't seen any franchises fold. There's been talk of expansions in two teams. The Canadian Association is no longer paying for Canadian players. They're actually just doing the World Cup this year. So I do think it is a much different situation. It doesn't seem as dire in the previous two attempts.
So Hot Takedown listeners, if you're in Houston, go buy a ticket to the Houston Dash game. Let us know how it is. What's the feel of the stadium? You can email us at contact@538.com. We'd love to hear about sort of what it's like to be at this game and how the crowd filled out and whether it's just diehards or people who heard about it from Hot Takedown, surely. That'll do it for this week's show. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps, anything where podcasts are played. Of course, we're on iTunes as well. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. If you review or rate the show, it really helps us. Thanks to Neil, as always, for coming.
Thanks, as always, to you, Chad.
And Kate. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks.
And right next to Kate, Allison. Allison, thanks again.
Thank you.
You can email us any of your comments at contact@538.com. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Thanks for listening. You'll hear from us again tomorrow. One more reminder for an emergency pod off the women's tournament. Talk to you then.